This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Master and Apprentice by Claudia Gray. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Prophecy in dreams is possible through the illumination of the active intellect over our soul. Ibn Rushda, also known as Averroes. It is a time of peace. The Galactic Republic, which has governed for thousands of years, has provided prosperity to many worlds and opportunity to most. Only a few shadows of conflict darken the galaxy, and these are handled by the Jedi Knights, the guardians of peace and justice throughout the Republic. One of those conflicts arises on the planet Teth, a source of corruption that threatens many nearby systems. The Jedi Council sends Qui-Gon Jinn and his young Padawan to investigate. But the criminal element on Teth has chosen not to cooperate. Chapter 1. There is no emotion. There is peace. There is no ignorance. There is knowledge. There is no passion. There is serenity. There is no chaos. There is harmony. Whoever wrote the Jedi Code, thought Qui-Gon Jinn, never had to deal with the Hutts. He ran through the stone passageway of the Hutt compound, the sound of blaster bolts echoing behind him, flashes of red lighting up the darkness like heat lightning. His pursuers would round the bend soon and have a clear shot, which made it a very good time to dash through the nearest door. Obi-Wan! He called. To the left!
Yes, Master!
Panted Obi-Wan, who was only steps behind Qui-Gon. Is he winded already? Qui-Gon thought as they dashed down a staircase that would lead to the outer, more modern area of the Hutt compound. Their escape thus far had included no more than a 3-minute run, and of course scaling a 20-meter wall. But in the proper meditative state, that shouldn't have been difficult. Obi-Wan hasn't perfected meditation and combat, Qui-Gon reminded himself as his Padawan's steps echoed behind his on the long staircase. By his age, I was able to. Qui-Gon stopped himself. Comparisons between his training and Obi-Wan's weren't constructive. Each individual had a different path to the Force. What he needed to be concentrating on was their path out of here. The darkness surrounding them was pierced below by light streaming in through an open doorway. Qui-Gon grabbed his lightsaber and activated it, illuminating the stairwell. Obi-Wan did the same, only a second behind him, and in time for them to run out of the stairwell into what turned out to be a very large, very crowded room. Specifically, one of the Hutt's spice hookah dens. Heavy, sweet smoke fogged the air. Musicians played atop various floating platforms, which hovered at different heights above the spice-addled denizens below. From his gilded dais, Wanbo the Hutt sucked in enough smoke to fill all three of his lungs. Nobody was alert enough to immediately notice the two Jedi Knights who'd appeared above them. But lightsabers tended to attract attention. Wanbo croaked, dazedly gesturing with his tail. One of his Gamorrean guards squealed and waddled to intercept them at the foot of the stairs. This concerned Qui-Gon far less than the heavy thudding of half a dozen human guards on the steps, only seconds behind, and two more Gamorreans at the door. Jump! Qui-Gon called. With that, he leapt across the room to land on one of the band platforms currently occupied by the horn section. The Kidanek stumbled back in alarm, and one of them toppled from the edge of the platform into the filthy, pillowed moat that surrounded Wanbo. She landed atop a Trandoshan, who hissed in protest, but most of the dazed group hardly seemed to notice. He glanced back. Obi-Wan's jump had taken him to the platform where a Shada Ub was playing the growdy harmonique. Unfortunately, this was a sterner species of musician. While the Shada Ub kept two steady limbs on the harmonique, he lashed out with another, then spat at Obi-Wan.
Poison,
Qui-Gon thought with horror, but Obi-Wan dodged easily. His Padawan's reflexes were sharp. If Obi-Wan lacked serenity in battle, he didn't lack instincts. As the human guards appeared at the top stairs, Qui-Gon called, "Handle that door!" With that, he stamped the platform control, sending it zooming toward the guards. Amid the fray, he called upon the deep quietness within, the soul of the universe that always listened, always answered. Without consciously thinking or aiming, Qui-Gon brought his lightsaber up, over, aside, blocking every blaster bolt. They fired faster, but it made no difference. He could sense each shot before it happened. His confidence was not shared by the Kitanak musicians, the rest of whom jumped from the platform. Good. That way, he could concentrate on only his own safety and his Padawan's. Of course, Obi-Wan could take care of himself. Or so Qui-Gon thought for the remaining 2 seconds before Obi-Wan swooped down over the door controls and stabbed them with his lightsaber, heat melting the controls from within. Blast it, Qui-Gon thought. I meant take care of the guards at the door.
You could have said so,
Obi-Wan shouted. Which was true. Always with the specific instructions. Must he be so literal? But this made little difference with 2 Gamorreans still between them and their best escape route. Worse, the control panel appeared to govern not only the door, but also the floating platforms, which went haywire. Qui-Gon stumbled as his platform tilted sharply to the left, yet he retained his balance. Barely. One blaster bolt seared past him to blow a smoking chunk from the wall. Even that one miss was too many. No time for hypotheticals, Qui-Gon reminded himself. There is no past, no future, only now. Obi-Wan did not appear to be trying to calm himself. He looked anything but calm, jumping down from his platform moments before it sent the Shada Ub and the Growdy into the wall with a musical crash. Yet he handily slashed through the axe of one Gamorrean and the arm of another, which sent the first squealing off in terror. This finally pierced the haze of spice and stupidity in Wombo the Hutt's head. The Gamorreans at the stairs began thumping down, no doubt to seize Qui-Gon when he fell from his crazily off-kilter platform.
Master! Obi-Wan called. Are you all right?
Just get us a ship if you can!
With a nod, Obi-Wan obeyed, dashing out of the spice den into the labyrinthine Hutt Palace of Teth. Qui-Gon gripped the edge of the platform as it careened toward Wanbo again. A few of the people below had begun to chortle at the spectacle of a Jedi clinging onto a band floater. Well, let them laugh. Better that they remain distracted, he thought as he flicked on a tracker unit at his belt. His hover platform whizzed toward a counterpart that remained mostly stationary, where a Kitanak huddled with his clue horn over his head. Qui-Gon jumped to that platform, a meter below, roughly in the center of the room. From there, he could steady himself to leap again, up and over, to land on his feet on the dais behind Wanbo, his lightsaber poised only centimeters from the Hutt's fleshy throat. Wanbo attempted to turn, not easy for Hutts, but Qui-Gon brought the lightsaber closer. The heat of the blade must have been palpable even through that thick skin, because Wambo went still. The human guards and the Gamorreans did as well. Most of the spice addicts sat up, finally interested in what was going on, though at least one woman on the floor continued to stare at the ceiling, her mouth open in an intoxicated smile. The last two platforms crashed into walls and fell, leaving no casualties that Qui-Gon could see. Wanbo remained silent, waiting to take his cues from his captor. Without his major domo, Wanbo had no idea how to handle any crisis whatsoever.
"Now that I have your attention," Qui-Gon said, "I'd like to discuss my departure from this palace."
"Chuba Jaji Bargam,"
Wanbo said sulkily, which more or less translated as, "Fine, I'm ready to see the last of you."
"The feeling is mutual. Now I'm taking this dais to the compound's hangar."
Fortunately, these things often could be raised or lowered between floors, the better to allow Hutts to remain motionless. To the room, Qui-Gon announced, "My ship will be waiting for me there. Wanbo should make a very good shield for any bolts you plan to fire."
"Shuka Jidai Unu Julinimi,"
Wanbo muttered. Since when do Jedi take hostages? It wasn't the kind of thing Jedi usually did. Not the kind of maneuver Qui-Gon liked to employ. Definitely not something the Jedi Council would be glad to hear about when he and Obi-Wan returned to Coruscant. But Qui-Gon tailored his tactics to his opponents. Against the Hutts, whose massive wealth had been derived solely through the misery of other beings, he felt free to do whatever it took to survive. "Since now, it appears," Qui-Gon said lightly. With that, he stamped on the controls, and the floor panel shifted from beneath them. Wanbo's small arms twitched as the platform descended from his spice den into his compound's hangar. Glancing upward, Qui-Gon could see several beings staring down at the spectacle, wide-eyed. Then he returned his attention to the hangar and saw Obi-Wan surrounded by five human guards, well-trained ones, to judge by their fighting stances. Although his Padawan still held his lightsaber ready, he could not simultaneously move forward to the ships and defend himself. Obi-Wan met Qui-Gon's eyes only for a moment, then looked away. Standing nearby was Thurible, Wanbo's human majordomo, his hands clasped in front of him, his smile relaxed.
"Master Jin,"
he said in his cultured, polite voice,
"how lucky we are to have both Jedi together at once."
Obi-Wan tensed, no doubt preparing for battle. Qui-Gon merely smiled.
"Very lucky," he said to Thurible.
He kept the lightsaber at Wanbo's throat.
"Especially as my tracker unit has been broadcasting for, quite a while now. The Jedi Council can't take part directly, of course, but they'll be able to review everything that's happened so far, and everything that will happen. It feels almost as though they're actually here."
Thurible's smile briefly flickered. The Gamorrean guard shuffled nervously on their clawed feet. As soon as Qui-Gon had discovered the duplicate shipment logs in the Teth records, Wanbo's forces had attacked. Thurible had planned for this contingency from the very beginning, and his plan had been set into action as soon as they realized the fake records weren't fooling anyone. The original scheme must have been to report the two Jedi missing under unknown circumstances in order to cover up their assassination. But not even the Hutts were brazen enough to openly kill Jedi Knights. In only an instant, Thurible had regained his calm.
"It appears you have taken my employer hostage. I, in turn, have taken your student hostage. We seem to be at an impasse, do we not?"
Instead of fighting his way out, Qui-Gon would have to bargain with the Hutts. It was all Qui-Gon could do not to groan. An hour later, Qui-Gon sat in the Major Domo's office, calmly sipping tea.
"These misunderstandings are so unfortunate," said Thurible, slowly pacing the curved stone wall of the office like a pilgrim meditating upon a path. He radiated a calm confidence, more like another Jedi than a crime lord's right-hand man. "We've had security problems in the past. The guards, well, they let their vigilance slip into paranoia from time to time."
"Indeed," Qui-Gon raised his eyebrow. "What reason could you have for paranoia here on Teth? The Hutts hold sole control here."
"You might be surprised," Thurible said. "The balance of power shifts constantly. None of us can afford to take anything for granted."
A Hutt's Major Domo was almost always a flunky, a hapless warm body who ran interference with local officials, simpered and flattered others in power, and exercised no independent authority at all. The average term of employment for a Major Domo lasted, as far as Qui-Gon could figure, a few months. So did the average Major Domo's life expectancy. Sooner or later, usually sooner, they either took bribes, got crossed, and were executed for cause, or were murdered for no cause whatsoever, when the Hutt in question lost his temper. Thurible was different. Wanbo the Hutt held his position only because of nepotism. He was unfit to lead a cartel, due to both his tiny brain and his enormous spice habit. Through what Qui-Gon assumed to be sheer luck, Wanbo had hired an individual as intelligent, cunning, and amoral as the mightiest of the Hutts. Thurible dressed like a poet or an artist, albeit a wealthy one, and spoke with more polish than an aristocrat of Coruscant. Yet everyone in the sector knew that Thurible was the real power on Teth. Though, of course, the Major Domo was too smart to say so himself. Obi-Wan had been released to save Wanbo and vice versa. The only way for Thurible to do this and save face was to pretend the attack had been spontaneous. Until they got off this planet, it would be wisest to play along. But if Thurible believed he had the upper hand over Qui-Gon now, he was very much mistaken.
"Again, I apologize for the terrible misunderstanding," Thurible said smoothly. His long, burnt-orange caftan trailed just above the floor, revealing flashes of his bare feet as he continued to pace. "Rest assured, the guards will be appropriately disciplined, yet kept alive in deference to the customs of the Jedi."
"I'm pleased to hear it."
Qui-Gon took another sip of his tea before adding, "There's no need for this unfortunate misunderstanding to eclipse the rest of our journey here." Thurible smiled and bowed, black curls falling around his face.
"You are generosity itself."
"So I'm told," Qui-Gon said, his voice dry. "I'm also still highly interested in precisely what's happening with agricultural shipments through the trialist trade route, especially given that the records of shipping in the nearby systems appear to be highly inaccurate."
The sudden shift to the offensive didn't make Thurible blink.
"We too are curious about this. To have so many ships going astray so suddenly, it's alarming for the Republic, I'm sure."
"Alarming may be too strong a word, but these disappearances are disruptive, and the Republic will ultimately take whatever measures are necessary to protect the shipments."
Thurible inclined his head again, though the obsequious tone had left his voice as he replied,
"How good it is to know that the Republic protects its many citizens so well."
Of course, Qui-Gon knew that the Hutts had been capturing and seizing these shipments, selling the foodstuffs to struggling independent planets of the Outer Rim. And Thurible knew that Qui-Gon knew. But as long as Qui-Gon could make the Hutts stop, at least for now, there was no point in a direct challenge. It would only lead to bloodshed, at the end of which the Republic would remain triumphant and strong. The huts would scramble and scurry through months of infighting, at the end of which a new set of crime lords would emerge to behave in exactly the same way.
Sometimes, Qui-Gon murmured, it feels as though nothing in the galaxy will ever change.
Thurible straightened, obviously unsure what to make of the shift in topic. Folding his hands together, he furrowed his dark brows.
Do you truly think so, Jedi?
There had been a time when Qui-Gon believed great transformative change was possible. That these changes had been foreseen millennia ago by the Jedi mystics. How young he'd been. How innocent. How optimistic. Time had taught him better.
Nothing remains static, Qui-Gon said. But sentient beings will always remain the same.
Thurible shook his head no.
Changes come when we least expect them, but they do come.
He was more on guard now than he had been when Qui-Gon held his lightsaber to Wanbo's neck. His dark eyes searched Qui-Gon's for something unguessable.
Who knows what transformations we may yet live to see?
Chapter 2.
Nice place, Alderaan, said Rahara Wick as the Merricks flew away from the planet. Beautiful, serene. Not to mention unsuspecting, Pax Marifer added with relish. I like that in a planet. Good, because it's the last place I want to run into any problems.
Why?
Pax frowned at her.
We'd face far harsher penalties virtually anywhere else.
Rahara crossed her arms.
Yeah, but on Alderaan we couldn't bribe our way out of it.
They are appallingly moral, aren't they?
No place for you and me.
Pax smiled mischievously. Sometimes he liked to pretend they were far more criminal than they actually were. Rahara, on the other hand, sometimes liked to pretend they weren't criminal at all. After all, they hurt no one. They took nothing of any value from the worlds they visited. Just rocks. But one planet's rock was another planet's jewel. Take Alderaan, for instance. Its archipelago continent was practically carpeted with a fine, whitish stone that was most often used as gravel. But take that stone to Rhodia, show it to Rhodians whose eyes detected some wavelengths humans didn't, and it became spectacular, iridescent, glittering. It became precious. Millennia ago, back in the days of legend, when the Sith still governed so much of the galaxy, gemstones had been traded freely. But flooding the market with a precious commodity tended to destroy the commodity's value. Sometimes it led to widespread looting or illicit mining on worlds whose ordinary stone was extraordinary elsewhere. An influx of such jewels could even collapse a planetary economy. So strict rules had been put in place to regulate and even ban the trading of most gems. She and Pax were simply pretending those rules didn't exist. They couldn't crash an entire world's economy, not just the two of them. As Pax had said to her when he first hired her as a co-pilot and analyst, who would notice if we took what little could fit in the Merricks' hold? Who would be the poorer? No one. So why shouldn't we be the richer? Rahara didn't see why not. It wasn't like they were real crooks. But it was something she had to tell herself time and time again. They were, in some ways, an unlikely pair. Rahara had grown up rough, to put it lightly, and taught herself everything she knew, while Pax had been educated by droids with memory banks containing endless data, droids with absolutely nothing else to do. She was tall, with golden skin and straight blue-black hair that fell to her waist. Pax was a few centimeters shorter, with wiry hair that sprang up from his head as though he'd been electrocuted, and a complexion so pale that strangers sometimes asked if he was from a planet where the population lived underground. His clothes were of the finest quality, but disheveled, and hung slightly on his skinny frame. Rahara wore plain black working garb she bought on the cheap from spaceport stalls, which could be made to look local almost anywhere with the addition of a simple cape or hood. They were both human. That was where the similarities ended.
"Most people write us off as an absent-minded scholar and his low-class pilot," Rahara thought.
That was fine by her. The important thing was that they be written off, overlooked, forgotten. She'd spent her childhood being monitored, being controlled. Rahara would never allow that to happen again.
Pax pulled the lever that sent the Merricks into hyperspace. As the view screens turned blue with wavering light, Rahara rose from her seat.
"I'm going to check the spectrometer." "No need to bother just yet," Pax said in his crisp Coruscanti accent. "We won't be heading to Rhodia for weeks."
It was important not to travel directly between the stone source and the market. That left a trail.
"Might as well."
In truth, silences between her and Pax had become awkward lately. Better to have something to do. Rahara went to the ladder and clambered down into the heart of the Merricks. In most Gozanti-class freighters, this space would be an ordinary cargo hold, stark bare metal and not that much light. In the Merricks, however, the entire space glowed golden, and at its heart lay thousands of kilograms of gemstones. She would have been impressed by Pax's scanner blocking field no matter what. But he hadn't only created the technology, he'd also made it beautiful. Beauty mattered to Pax, she knew. Whether or not he'd ever admit it, that was the real reason he stole jewels rather than other, easier, more lucrative cargo. He just liked looking at them. But Pax Marifer would never admit he did anything for sentimental reasons. Pulling her hair into a ponytail, Rahara stripped off the robe that had helped her pass unnoticed through Aldera. She stepped to the scanner blocking field's controls, which were fiendishly complicated. She'd been working with Pax for a pretty long while now, and still she needed to review them every time. Pax didn't understand what people meant by user-friendly. Either you were smart enough to use his tech, or you weren't. Once ready, she pushed her sleeves back to her elbows and then punched in the commands that took the field down, a flood of brightening light followed by darkness for just a split second. That was enough time for her to grab a large handful of their hull. When she was only centimeters clear, the field re-energized with a blinding flare. Blinking, Rahara congratulated herself on not getting singed this time.
"You know," Pax said from the ladder behind her, "we've made what is known as a clean getaway. You can turn the field off."
"You say that every time, and every time I tell you I need to practice operating the field in tighter time frames."
"I would have thought you'd have it by now."
Carrying the gems, Rahara stalked over to the other side of the hold where the spectrometer bench sat.
"I would have thought you'd have learned how to interact with other human beings by now, instead of suggesting everyone in the galaxy is a moron besides you."
"Looks like we're both disappointed."
She laid the stones on the bench and began separating them by size and probably quality. Rahara had first been put to work sorting minerals when she was only 9 years old. To her, this was almost automatic.
"Rahara," Pax said more quietly, "I'm sorry if I hurt you. I meant it as a joke."
He hadn't hurt her, merely irritated her. But that was bad enough. Sometimes she got weary of a partner who acted more like a protocol droid than a human being, even if he did have a good excuse.
"Do you see anybody laughing?"
"I do not. Obviously, my understanding of humor requires refinement."
That, of course, made her chuckle. Pax was funniest when he didn't try.
"We ought to talk," Pax said, as Rahara strapped on her magnifying goggles.
about our next destination.
Gamor, right? Which would be disgusting, but at least they could call on their fresh memories of Alderaan to get them through weeks of dredging fetid swamps.
So excited about that.
You're being sarcastic.
Let me assure you that this lack of enthusiasm is entirely mutual. The thing is, I've been thinking.
Pax leaned closer, peering down his long nose at the white gravel on the bench.
We can collect Gamorrean coral anytime. But what if we went after something rarer? Rather, more valuable?
Like what, Mustafar fire diamonds? Rahara had never been to Mustafar, but from what she'd heard, it would make working on Gamor seem like a journey to paradise.
Nothing so dangerous.
He half turned to face her as he said,
Kyber crystals.
Kyber!
Are you nuts?
Rahara pushed her goggles atop her head, the better to look him in the eyes.
The Jedi police Kyber trading well, more closely than anything we've ever traded. Or anything we ever should trade.
Yet, a black market still exists, as well as certain industrial applications. And if no industry will buy from us, and the markets in question are rather too black for our comfort, well, we could alert the Jedi to a new trove of Kyber. Make some friends. It could come in handy someday, having friends among the Jedi.
That made more sense. Still,
Kyber isn't found in that many places. The Jedi control those areas. Are you seriously suggesting we try to steal from them?
Pax scoffed. Please, I'm not suicidal.
I'm daring. I'm also the person who might have found a completely undiscovered Kyber source. On the moon of a perfectly safe world, even. No guards, no danger, a pleasant climate, and, if my analysis is correct, a very large number of Kyber crystals.
Rahara had seen Pax combing through various planetary scans for hours on end, all public information, yet too minute and dense for most people to search through without already knowing what they were looking for. But he saw more than others did. She said,
I knew there was a reason I put up with you.
A grin spread across Pax's face.
Then let's hunt some Kyber.
Traveling home proved awkward. Obi-Wan was obviously hoping to avoid talking about what had gone wrong during the firefight on Teth. No wonder for someone so young. In many ways, Obi-Wan was so mature for his age, so steady, that Qui-Gon sometimes forgot he was just 17 years old. Only in moments like this, as they sat side by side in the cockpit of the Rainhawk-class shuttle, did Qui-Gon realize how gawky his Padawan still was. How both the past child and the future man could be glimpsed in his face. As always during those moments, Qui-Gon felt a pang of guilt. Obi-Wan had such potential, such promise. He deserved a master who could bring it out in him. They'd been an uneasy match from the start, with misunderstandings and emotional swings. That in itself wasn't unusual. Qui-Gon sometimes questioned why Padawans were transferred from the creche to their masters in the middle of most species' adolescence. Exactly when every change became more difficult. He, like Dooku and Yoda and Yoda's old master before him, had taken a younger Padawan. Obi-Wan had become his apprentice at 13. This had not helped. Qui-Gon had talked things through with fellow masters such as Mace Windu and Depa Balaba, even Yoda, all of whom assured Qui-Gon that the initial months were almost always rough.
Worry you should, if conflict arises not,
Yoda had intoned.
Then growing enough, your Padawan cannot be.
Had Qui-Gon's first months with Dooku been so different? But he had forged a powerful bond with Dooku well before they'd been together for a year. Most masters and apprentices did. Yes, Rael had helped at first, but he and Dooku would have come together regardless. It was Dooku who had guided Qui-Gon through the ancient Jedi prophecies, igniting interests in ancient history and linguistics that would long survive his fervent belief in the mystic's foresight. Besides that, they'd shared so many personality traits. Self-reliance, skepticism, and a reluctance to take the Council's word as sacred. The characteristics he and Dooku had in common were almost entirely the ones for which he and Obi-Wan were exact opposites. Qui-Gon believed in dealing with each situation on its own merits. Obi-Wan wanted procedures to follow. Qui-Gon valued flexibility, which Obi-Wan seemed to think of as sloppiness. Qui-Gon had learned to get on better with the Council over time, but had always retained his independence. Obi-Wan still thought he had to obey the Council in every particular, at all times, and was horrified every time Qui-Gon deviated from standard protocols in the slightest. None of this made Obi-Wan a bad candidate to become a Jedi Knight. Many Jedi Knights, some of the best, thought and acted along the same lines. But it made him an awkward match for Qui-Gon. Years into their partnership, they still remained out of sync. Had the situation been more dire today, if the threat in the Hutt Palace had been more serious, that gap in their mutual understanding could well have gotten them killed.
How do I fix this? Qui-Gon wondered. Can I?
Obi-Wan deserves no less.
I'm sorry about before, Master, Obi-Wan finally said. I should have understood what you meant by getting the door and letting myself get caught stealing a ship.
Obi-Wan, the fault was mine.
Qui-Gon lay one broad hand on Obi-Wan's shoulder.
First I gave you unclear instructions. And a better master could have taught his Padawan to understand his battle instincts by now. But I knew you probably wouldn't be able to get a ship all by yourself. It was worth a try, that's all. You're not to blame.
Most Padawans would be relieved to be off the hook. Obi-Wan only frowned.
I can do better.
Qui-Gon sighed.
We both can. Now let's get home.
On the planet Pyjul, beneath a blazing sunset, the race was on.
Come on!
Shouted Rael Averroes, urging his mount onward, toward a wide gash in the ground, deep and stony. The Viractyl chirruped as it sprang forward, crossing the chasm in one bound. As its heavy, clawed feet thudded onto the grass, Averroes laughed out loud.
There we go!
He cried in his thick Ringo Vinden accent.
That's it!
Viractyls had been imported from Utapau some decades ago by the Iltan clan to give themselves an edge in the Grand Hunt. By now, those original creatures had been bred into streamlined, swift, crimson-feathered Viractyls unique to Pyjul. Someday, Averroes figured, the rest of the galaxy would discover the Pyjul Viractyls, and after that, no one would ever raise Fathiers again. For the time being, however, these creatures, their speed, the sheer joy of riding them, belonged to Pyjul alone. Averroes sighted the finished beacon and silently directed his Viractyl toward it. The beast responded instantly, accelerating with every bit of its strength to reach the end as fast as possible. Viractyls loved speed for its own sake, and Averroes thought they even understood the difference between winning and losing. His mount trilled its battle cry as it dashed past the line, skidding to a stop so fast its claws cut sharp lines in the loamy ground. With a grin, Averroes reached into the gear basket and grabbed a large stick of mollusk jerky, the Pyjul delicacy he couldn't stand. The Viractyl appreciated the stuff more, chewing with relish. Other riders reached the line, shouting their congratulations and friendly taunts as they did so. Averroes hopped to the ground as they began leading the Viractyls back to the palace stables. He shook his head ruefully just after he landed. Next to him, Captain Darren, stoic as ever, asked,
"Is there a problem?"
"Just wondering why my knees are rude enough to age along with the rest of me."
"You could get synthetic replacements,"
No big deal. You know what they say about getting old? It beats the alternative.
Avaros tried to remember that. Force knew he'd seen too many people fall before their time. If sometimes, in the morning, he looked at himself in the mirror and wondered who that graying old geezer was, well, that was proof he wasn't dead yet. And he intended to live his remaining life to the fullest. Once they reached the stables, the servant boys took the Viractyl's reins from the riders and walked the beasts off for dust baths and feed. Darren and some of the other soldiers went back to their barracks afterward, but Avaros led the larger group to the nearest cantina. It wasn't exactly palatial. A muddy hole carved out of a dingy rock which smelled a fair bit like the Wookiee bartender, but that was one reason Avaros liked the place. The customers gave a cheer of welcome as he strode in, and the hostess, Selby, who had blonde hair, a saucy smile, and large breasts, gave him a warm smile as she took his long cloak. The rider closest to Avaros leaned in and muttered, "The two of you back on, then?"
"Maybe."
Avaros didn't indulge in female companionship often. When people found out about it, they got distracted, made a fuss. It wasn't often worth it. But it had been a while, and Selby was decently close to his own age, and she had the bawdiest sense of humor of anyone he'd ever met.
"Why not?" he figured. Might as well see if she was game.
He gestured toward Selby, and she lit up as she began moving toward him.
"Hey!"
grunted a gigantic Chagrian, who was obviously already drunk. His grayish-blue hand clutched Selby's elbow.
"I was talking to her. I was getting somewhere."
"The places you were," Selby retorted.
"Get along, then. You've had enough."
"Throwing me out now? For that?"
With his free hand, he gestured vaguely in Avaros's direction.
"Muddy boots, unshaved face, no manners, that's what you like. Believe me, I could keep you in better style."
"You must be new here." Selby pulled herself free. "Nobody keeps me. I keep myself."
"Give me a chance, girl."
The Chagrian tried to pull Selby closer, but she tugged herself free of his drunken grasp. This only made him angrier.
"Who do you think you are? Turning down the likes of me when you're trash? Nothing but trash!"
It was obvious Selby didn't care what insults the Chagrian hurled at her. But that didn't mean Avaros shouldn't step in. Besides, he'd enjoy it.
"Hey, you,"
he said to the Chagrian.
"Get out before I take you out."
The Chagrian's chest swelled. If he couldn't get himself a woman, he seemed to think a fight would be the next best thing.
"Take me out, eh? And how do you think you'll do that?"
In a blink, Avaros's hand went to his belt, seizing his weapon. His lightsaber blazed into life, its blue glow illuminating the entire room. The Chagrian froze as the cantina fell silent. Avaros grinned.
"Bet I could manage."
"Jedi,"
muttered the Chagrian. Already he was shuffling backward toward the door, head bowed.
"I didn't know you. You don't look like a Jedi."
"Huh," Avaros said. "I always figured other Jedi don't look like me."
"I'll report you."
The Chagrian shook his horns, as close as he could get to being threatening now.
"Jedi or not, you're answerable to the law. The authorities will hear about this."
Selby had her hands on her hips and looked like she'd never had so much fun.
"Welcome to Pygel. Until our princess grows up, we're ruled by a regent."
She gestured grandly to Avaros.
"Meet our Lord Regent."
The Chagrian backed out of the cantina to laughter and jeers from the others. The music started up again, and Avaros switched off his lightsaber as he turned back to Selby with a smile.
But that was when the holoscreen behind the bar lit up, its borders red. The grin faded from Avaros's face, even before the image sharpened to reveal a warehouse outside the capital city, smoldering in the last stages of a fire. If Princess Fanry was watching this, and surely she was, it would terrify her. He'd have to get back to her immediately.
Do these monsters even think about the people they hurt?
While firefighting droids wheeled about, extinguishing the blaze, a label appeared at the top of the holoscreen. Suspected opposition activity.
Halen Azucca, he muttered. I'll send her to hell. Chapter 3.
Get the door! Why didn't I understand what Qui-Gon meant? The guards were the problem, not the door controls. And if I'd been calm, I would have seen that. Though, of course, he could have just said exactly what he meant, and then... I must keep my mind on the present. The future does not exist. The past has ceased to be. Only the present is real. Obi-Wan forced his attention back to the Rainhawk's controls. At least nobody would criticize his flying. There, the tasks were concrete, predictable, known. As he set the course for Coruscant, he ventured, "Did you gain any further insight about Thurible when you two spoke?" Qui-Gon shook his head, a rueful smile on his lips.
"Hardly. That one reveals almost nothing while hinting at almost everything. Not a bad way to develop a reputation for inscrutability."
"You'd know about being inscrutable," Obi-Wan thought. "Thurible's tactics make no logical sense."
"Oh, I'm sure they do."
Qui-Gon rose to his feet. In the small Rainhawk cockpit, his height and broad shoulders made it seem as though the ship could hardly contain him.
"The problem is, we can't judge another's logic until we know his ultimate objective. And Thurible's remains hidden."
"Master, are you going to your cabin?"
"I wish to meditate," Qui-Gon replied. "Don't worry, Obi-Wan. I won't leave you to fly the ship the entire time. I know how you dislike it."
Obi-Wan laughed at his master's sarcasm. As Qui-Gon well knew, Obi-Wan loved flying. "I believe I can bear the burden." Qui-Gon's low chuckle was his only farewell as he walked back toward his small cabin, leaving Obi-Wan alone. "See, he's joking around with you. He wouldn't joke around if he was truly disappointed in your performance on Teth." Yet there had been so many disappointments, so many shortcomings. The fault could not be Qui-Gon's. He was the master and Obi-Wan was but the student. Even though Qui-Gon Jinn could be contradictory, mysterious, vague, despite the fact that he sometimes did the exact opposite of what the temple leaders would have counseled. If Qui-Gon was, well, unorthodox, his Padawan's job was to gain understanding of that and adjust to it accordingly. In theory. In fact, Obi-Wan still could not predict when and how his master would ignore the rules. Rarely did he understand why. And as he grew older, he became more and more frustrated with Qui-Gon's renegade nature. "Rules are rules for a reason," Obi-Wan thought as he stared out at the wavering electric blue light of hyperspace. "They're not arbitrary. The Jedi rules exist to steer us toward the greater good and to reduce uncertainty." Better yet, rules could be memorized. They could be written down, studied, made certain. They were the opposite of the archaic, mystical writings Qui-Gon seemed to value more than any other texts of the Order. Obi-Wan preferred certainty when it could be had. Most frustrating of all, Qui-Gon's methods worked most of the time. Whatever changeable madness he steered by, it steered him well. Which meant there was something important about being a Jedi that Obi-Wan didn't yet understand.
"By the Force, I'm brilliant!"
Modesty was not a virtue where Pax had grown up, which might be why he'd never acquired it. In his opinion, modesty sounded boring.
Obviously, I am not the first to study the potential of Kyber crystals, Pax reasoned as he prepared to take the Merricks out of hyperspace.
However, almost all such studies will have been conducted by the Jedi. Any results that could create an ever greater market for Kyber would not have been shared openly. Yet possessing the crystals is not illegal on any world I've ever heard of.
This might have simply been because Pax never much bothered finding out what was legal or illegal on every single world. Details, details, blah, blah, blah.
That was Rahara's department. She was a worrier, that one. Then again, who could blame her?
Almost there?
Rahara asked cheerfully as she returned to the cockpit. Her silky black hair was tied back from her face, which was aesthetically pleasing.
You know perfectly well that we're almost there.
She leaned back in her chair, resting her feet on the console, a liberty Pax would have allowed for no one else. And you know that pleasant conversation sometimes begins with everyone affirming what they already know.
I was brought up to believe that directness is a virtue.
Rahara sighed.
You were brought up by protocol droids. They're not exactly experts at normal human communication. But you could get the knack of it, if you'd practice.
Waste of time,
Pax said. Her lips pursed, but she said nothing else. On the whole, Pax felt he should be relieved. He liked Rahara more than he liked just about any other biological life form he'd known. When he'd taken her on several months ago, he'd known she was a perfect fit for the work he did, but hadn't realized how easy she would be to get along with, nor how pleasant it would be to talk with her or hear her laugh. It had taken him a while to recognize that the energy between them had shifted from co-workers to friends, and then from friends to something more. One evening, as they shared a bottle of wine, it had seemed as though things might... get out of hand. So Pax had taken that opportunity to explain that, really, human emotions were short-lived and fallible, and no basis for rational people to interact. Rationality was the only thing that really mattered, wasn't it? To judge by Rahara's reaction that night, she didn't agree. But they continued on as before, albeit with a few more awkward pauses. Pax felt she should be satisfied with that. Surely, eventually he would be. He grinned as he put his hands on the controls and said to her,
"Now, allow me to present to you the happily obscure world of Pygel."
The Merrick slipped out of hyperdrive at standard approach distance, revealing a planet dominated by abundant blue oceans, ringed with broad green and gold islands at its equator and tropics. To his surprise, ancient planetary shield generators orbited Pygel, which meant a few other vessels were also hanging back, waiting for landing clearance. In Pax's opinion, a planetary shield that ancient was probably too weak to keep out any ship larger than a Theta-class shuttle. Probably, the wait for landing clearance was a mere formality. Anyway, Pax didn't need to go to Pygel itself. Instead, he gestured at its darkly verdant moon.
"Behold what I believe to be the single best source of Kyber in the entire galaxy."
Rahara stared out at the scene before them, her face expressionless.
"You might show some enthusiasm," Pax suggested.
"Or at least interest."
She said nothing, only rose to her feet. Not once did she glance toward Pax. Had he violated some unknown social etiquette rules? The 3PO protocol droids who'd raised him had taught him how to recite etiquette rules for 1,000 different planets, but very little about how to put them into practice. Sentience behavior was rarely clear-cut, often complex, and invariably nothing like the simulations. Pax mostly responded to this by ignoring etiquette altogether. Yet he also knew that when he ignored the rules, Rahara's feelings could be hurt. She was the last person in the galaxy he would wish to hurt. He ventured, Of course I'm aware, highly aware, that I could never have analyzed the planetary data if not for your preliminary analysis of the mineralogical tables. A brilliant calculus for the data. You didn't say Zerka ships would be here. Rahara's voice was dull and flat. How had he missed it? Pax inwardly cursed himself as he picked out the Zerka Corporation cruiser Leverage, long and bulky, probably capable of carrying 10,000 souls. Other Zerka ships showed up on scans, indicating that the company did considerable work on Pygel and its moon.
I didn't know. I'm sorry.
Of course you didn't know, she said. Her dark eyes stared at the ship as though it were an enemy. In some senses, he supposed it was. You didn't check.
You can't know unless you check.
Pax didn't feel it necessary to check for the presence of Zerka Corporation in every single system, regardless of what Rahara had endured in her youth. However, this was a subject to raise at another time when she wasn't pale and trembling, and Zerka wasn't represented by a ship large enough to haul away a reasonably large percentage of an entire asteroid belt in its cargo hold. Doing his best to speak gently, he said only,
If you'd rather we left, there are other jewels in the galaxy.
No, I don't see why Zerka should get to keep me from a major score. Rahara pushed up her sleeves, a gesture that usually meant she was strengthening her resolve. With a sidelong look at him, she added, Besides, if you flew away without checking for the Kyber, you wouldn't be able to stand it. I salute both your courage and your compassion for my base nature. To the moon we go! Pax steered the Merricks in that direction, pretending not to notice the way Rahara stared at the Zerka vessel until it had all but vanished in the distant night. Chapter 4
Strange the Hutt's behavior is.
Master Yoda scratched his chin, tiny clawed hand stroking the few white whiskers there.
Yet important I feel it is not.
I concur. Mace Windu leaned back in his chair. They're petty criminals who try to appear more powerful than they are. Attacking you was a dangerous gambit, but one that fits into their general pattern of behavior.
Qui-Gon wasn't entirely sure he agreed, but he let it lie. If the Hutts were going to create more trouble, the rest of the galaxy would find out soon enough. Besides, when it came to the Jedi Council, he knew he had to choose his battles. He chose a great many of them, though fewer in recent years than he once had. As ever, after a mission, Qui-Gon had been summoned to the Jedi Council's chambers for his report. It was nighttime, later than the Council usually met, at least for ordinary business, and the darkness around them was illuminated by the cyclone of Coruscanti traffic and ship's lights. Yet here, within this room, a sense of serenity prevailed. Qui-Gon relished the contrast. Master Balaba leaned forward, studying her datapad with a frown on her face.
It worries me, this misunderstanding between you and your Padawan. This isn't the first time you've reported such difficulties.
Qui-Gon bowed his head slightly.
It worries me as well. Obi-Wan is strong in the Force and eager to do his duty. The failure must be mine. Fundamentally, I fear we are a mismatch. I've been unable to adapt my teaching methods to his needs, despite my best efforts.
Yoda cocked his head.
Adapt he must as well. Cooperation is learned, not through individual effort. Only together can you progress.
Agreeing to that proposition, sensible though it was, would mean shifting some of the blame onto Obi-Wan, which Qui-Gon preferred not to do. He simply remained quiet. The Jedi Council had a habit of assuming that silence equaled agreement. Qui-Gon had found this habit useful from time to time. Regardless, he expected the Council to eventually ask him if he wanted them to reassign Obi-Wan's training to another master. He'd known before this meeting began that they might even ask the question tonight, but he still wasn't sure what he would say.